Hello, world. This is Byron Dieter, and we are back with another season of Cloud Giants brought to you by Bessemer Venture Partners. This is the podcast where we talk to the entrepreneurs, founders, and leaders who have built world-changing cloud companies. On August 10th, we're going live with the 2021 edition of the Cloud 100, where we'll feature the definitive ranking of the top private cloud companies in 2021. In the spirit of our Cloud 100 season, we're interviewing a cloud giant who not only graduated from the list, but also did so with record-breaking success in its most recent IPO in April, raising more than $1.3 billion and trading for tens of billions of dollars today. That's right. On our show today, we have Daniel Dines, co-founder and CEO of UiPath, the fastest growing and leading provider of robotic process automation, the AI software that spans the world. UiPath raised $2 billion of venture capital on their journey, and today trades well above $30 billion in the public markets. With over 3,000 employees, including the largest engineering organization devoted to RPA, Daniel is committed to helping organizations leverage UiPath to rapidly scale digital business operations and empower workers by automating their tasks and unlocking the human creativity and ingenuity along the way. Personally, I'm especially excited to talk with Daniel today, as he's actually my first Cloud 100 guest that I didn't work with as an investor or otherwise know extremely well, otherwise from working together for many years. Daniel and I first met at the Cloud 100 event 2 years ago, in fact, when he was the cover story, and the list was revealed to me, and I was inspired by his journey and his personal story. Daniel, we're eager to get to the UiPath story as it's such an inspiring and massive tale of success, but we have to do some justice to your personal founding story and the early days of your career and family life. Can you tell us the story of Romania and growing up in 1990 in a world that had just fallen through revolution? Communism was ending, and the country itself was in a period of massive entrepreneurship and transition. And perhaps what seeds did that sow in the person you became to found UiPath?
It was a very interesting time, Byron. Before 1990, it was a very quiet time. We had like 20 years when we were stuck in time. Nothing happened, and we couldn't envision anything to happen. And suddenly and unexpectedly, the fall of communism and everything has accelerated for good, for the worse, for everything. But it was a huge acceleration. It was a very colorful type of life that we had in the beginning. It was very poor, but also kind of interesting in the sense I had to make my own living. You know, my parents kind of, they divorced and they got, they were not able anymore to sustain me. It was a tremendous time. So I had to, I basically made my own life since I was 19. So it was really a lot of hardship, but in a way, it was fun. It was colorful. Again, when I got into Microsoft in early 2000, it was, again, I was having, again, the sense that I am stuck in time. It was like pre-war to communism, this lost decade of Microsoft, 2000, 2005, when I was there. It looked to me a bit like communism. Nothing was really moving. Everything was stuck. And then, you know, life accelerated again after 2005 when I returned to Romania. And I think even the world moved a bit past Microsoft and, you know, started the new startup movement. I traced it back like to around 2005.
For folks listening out there thinking about founding something, I always love to understand, what was the genesis moment? What was the founder union? Can you talk through what was the inspiration for the company, how you met your co-founder, and how you made the decision to jump out to actually do this?
Well, I always wanted to build something, to create something. So since I was 13, and I wanted to become a writer, and then I decided I'm not good at this, but I still had this passion. And I think I traced back this passion even, you know, since I was 9 or 10, building stuff on my grandparents' garden or something. I feel there is a certain trait for entrepreneurship that some people have it. It requires a drive. I don't know where it comes from. So after my 5 years with Microsoft, I decided to go back to Romania to start a company, which is a stupid decision because you don't have access to capital, you don't have access to talent.
It clearly worked out, but maybe contrarian at the time.
So the only good thing in Romania, I think, from the perspective of starting a company, is that you can tap into engineering talent and it doesn't cost you a leg. And especially like 15 years ago, and this is how I met all the other co-founders. Basically, I hired him in the company. And at some point when we were certain we will build UiPath, and this is we found product market fit when I kind of rebranded Discover as UiPath, I brought everyone from the initial engineers as co-founders in the company. So that's the founding story.
Fabulous. And there's more of an evolution here than often is the case with companies. As I understand it, there was this journey where you went through kind of many years of evolution. And over, I think it was, 8 or so years where the business was building, but going from kind of zero to 500K. And this, many of these blockbuster overnight successes take many years in the making. But talk through that those early years. Was it RPA at the time? I know it wasn't UiPath by name, but what was that early insight, and what was the foundation that you laid that allowed for the explosive growth to come later?
So we had some pivots along the way. We started as a consumer basically as an outsourcing company to bootstrap our products. And then we got into consumer products. They didn't work. Took a piece of technology from that consumer that was that piece that is able to understand the screens and converted into an OEM business. That OEM business was the only one that we were able to make it relatively successful. So it generated kind of a lifestyle business for us, Byron, like 100 to 200K per year, like in 2010, 2011. And that was really not what I wanted from life. I felt that I ruined my career. I went into doing anything, but I was better at nothing in the same time. As an engineer, I still had the pride of my guilt as building something and deeply understanding something. So but that journey was essential for my formation as CEO. As a CEO, in a way, it's a guy that knows a lot of things about many things, but doesn't know really well anything. So it's a special training to get there. So
you're being humble, and as I understand it, you have some pretty good coding skills yourself and have been known to even get in there on the product at times. But it sounds like you were inspired by what could be, at least in terms of building building a tech platform rather than a services business. And the interesting thing is that you essentially found the intersection of both, which was to take the services tasks and put them in a product. So what was that transition period like? You raised some venture capital money, you changed the company name, and then did you flip a switch and become a product company in 2014? What was that sort of reinvention period that really was this phase two and the basis for this, decacorn business you have today?
No, we've become a product company, I would say around 2012. When we started to build on the top of our little engine, OEM technology, we started to build this platform with our studio. It's our low-code, no-code development platform, and later on Orchestrator. So I would trace our true born as a product company around 2012. And that was the year when we stopped completely all outsourcing. So we started to live completely out of our product, but we raised capital first time in 2015. We raised just a small round to the later rounds, 1.6 million. And that was my beginning, my transformation into more of a sales guy. So I started to read about sales, to, you know, understand and how to build a sales team. It's very interesting. One story that you'll like it.
Initially, yeah, and I'll tell you, our readers or listeners always love the go-to-market stories as they're trying to figure it out. And so that transformation, particularly from a tech founder, is particularly exciting for those out there doing it.
So we realized initially that we need this new type of engineers that are not writing code into the product, but they go to customers and help them figure out how to use our product. And we didn't know how to call them, and we didn't want to be disrespectful to them in a way. So we call them the Fantastics. And this is
awesome.
It remained, you know, for a long time, the name of the group. We still use it internally.
And this was your sort of first sales team? They were the Fantastics?
Yeah. And it was absolutely... I didn't believe at that time in salespeople per se. So we didn't have any sales typical reps. But these guys that were called pre-sales engineers in our world were very good, you know, very energetic, clients loved them. So and we were kind of it was really not facing customers. We didn't fly people to customers. It was only online. So I think it was a really effective way to get, to get the engine started with our Fantastics. And later on in 2016, I started to hire true sales reps and building go-to-market engine and starting our more direct sales. But I love this, you know, working only with pre-sales engineers, young guys, smart. We always trumped the competition with these guys. When they showed we knew when they showed for a POCs or for a pilot, they would always win.
Well, your sales model has certainly worked. You've landed an amazing roster of the Fortune 1000. You've got some of the biggest deals out there. What was that kind of mid-stage sales motion, and what is it today? How's it evolved to? I understand that you have a partnership strategy that's highly effective with consulting firms, whereas you could have chosen to compete with them. It sounds like you've got real technical resources involved in this motion, more than kind of the account execs from central casting, perhaps. What was that that magic enabler for you? What was that go-to-market unlock for you that worked that others should think about perhaps for their businesses?
Myron, in time I developed this simple philosophy that you really have to understand which wave you caught. And you build your business strategy according to, you know, how fast this wave goes. It's like in surfing. You cannot fight a wave. You definitely cannot go faster than it. So you, for some reason, we were able to understand this. So initially, this working only with pre-sales engineers was the best way because we were a completely indirect company. We didn't have the muscle to talk to big enterprises. I didn't even know how they source software. I didn't know anything about this. So we used our pre-sales engineers mostly to talk with partners, with SIs, and we trained their people. And it was a lot of early stage of building this industry, a lot of pilots, POCs, all this stuff. So it was essential that we were completely indirect in a way, and we trained our partners. Later on, We realized we need a direct sales force. And that was a different stage of the company when we got to really build the direct. It was truly after our Series A in like 2017, we I started to understand a bit the world. The world knew about us. So building direct made sense. And it was very interesting. Some of we had two big competitors. One of them went completely indirect, like we were in the beginning. And with our direct force, we were able to really make our case. You will never win completely indirect, especially when it's too early. After you dominated the market and you squeezed everything, you can be completely indirect, but not in the early phases. So we've built our direct motion while we still, you know, had our partner ecosystem. So that was really essential to push them both in 17, in 18, in 19. Later on, we also built our professional service team, which grew. It's decent sized right now. We have a few hundred of people in this team, and you can build it in a way that you don't affect the relationship with partners. Again, we are using this team to propel them, to train them, to help them. We if they fail, we will go there and deliver for them. We take our partners with us in deals. Our goal in our professional service team is not to make money. It's to really help customers and partners succeed. So you always have to adapt, you know, to where we are. I don't believe there are clear recipes into how to build. Once you decided that you want to build this and you want to build this, you go and listen to people, you do this, but you always have to understand the wave you are riding at that point, if that makes sense.
So I want to come back to your competitive comment and perhaps the tennis analogy, but first let's talk about your surfing analogy, and specifically this idea of when growth comes and how to do it. How do you think about the cause and effect of your venture capital decision? Did the money allow you to be aggressive and grow faster? Were you growing faster so you needed to raise the money? Was it somewhere in between? What were the takeaways there?
Yeah, I think it's somewhere in between. It's clearly the money powered our growth. We couldn't have built it without investing ahead in our business. And we could have not built it without the relationships, introductions. It's an ecosystem that you know very well, that the investors provide to you. In the same time, it's interesting. We are making take how much money we are making this year, if I deduct from all my investments the money that we have in the bank, our revenue will be higher this year than all the money that we ever raised. In the same time, our revenue throughout the years, you know, since the inception of the company, it's clear to me looking at this math that, you know, the investments really accelerate. Hey, you disappeared.
You had several takeaways from your sales learnings, including this notion that you can never go direct channel early, and also this idea that there are different models that are right for different companies, and even interestingly, this idea that there's different answers for the same company at different points in time. Do you feel that that's true and that as a CEO, you need to constantly be looking for what model is right for you and that that could evolve massively from direct to indirect, from enterprise to SMB, even in the course of a company's lifetime?
Yeah, I'm a big believer. You always have to be on the watch for what's going on and be able to change your strategy, your tactics, everything. I hate when I challenge again people and they say, I remember we made the decision. Who cares if we made the decision? If we have new data, we can do another decision. To me, it's a very simple simple math. If you look, if you look into it, if you make a decision today, that helps you accumulate data faster. And then when you have enough data, you make another decision that accelerates and accelerates, and you make better and better decisions. I think some people believe that truth is something you can truly achieve in this life. While I'll tell my people, truth is like the limit in math. You get as close to it, but you'll never reach it. So you can always improve on it.
I love that concept. And let's use that to build into your tennis analogy and the idea that sometimes competition makes a player better. Did you find that was the case for you? And specifically, I'm intrigued by the Blue Prism IPO in 2016. And perhaps that is a catalyzing event for your team when you'd been pioneering RPA, you'd been in the market and saw what was possible. What impact did that have on you in terms of your thinking? And how do you think the competitive dynamics in a business setting for smaller private companies can be a positive or a negative as well?
I'm thinking quite a lot of less tennis lessons that can be applied in business. And one interesting lesson, and it relates to this Blue Prism IPO, is that if you play someone and you know that you are better than them, and because I knew at that time our technology was better, there is no way some random guys, engineers out of Romania, to build a company that will beat some public companies without a better technology. So we had this better, more modern tech. So we knew this. I never doubted my technology. But if we, when in tennis, when you play someone that is not better than you, but it has more hype, it has different ways of playing, you might get tight and you might lose. And it happens a lot of time. So what is the, to me, the lesson is don't be intimidated by big guys in this. You really have to ride the moment. Be in the zone, be in that moment. Do what your gut feeling is telling you. Don't overthink. Maybe it's in contradiction to what I said in before, because you always have to change. But sometimes when you overthink, it's not gonna work. It's a flow that you have to, but if you trust yourself and you do the right things, it doesn't matter. They are 10 times bigger than you. And we had in like Automation Anywhere was a company that was maybe, 20 to 50 times bigger than us in terms of revenue and number of people in like 2015. But it doesn't matter. If you are in the right trajectory at some point and the growth rate is higher, at some point you meet them and then you jump ahead of them. But don't get tight. This is the don't try necessarily to win. I think winning is a byproduct of doing the right things. And it's truly in life and in business, in everything.
At that moment in 2016, when Blue Prism went public, they were billions, the rocket ship, et cetera. And to your point, by playing your game, you've now gotten to the point where I think your market cap is 40 times there and the like. And so there's this beauty and rhythm in playing your game, which I love. There's also this unique international element that's all the more relevant these days as hybrid cultures are being forced upon companies, but also likely more of the future. Talk about this global approach that you've had from day one and what have been the strengths for you from that. And are there takeaways that people should learn from as they build businesses today, and advice that you have in building these global teams for many people out there who maybe didn't intend to do that from the start?
Yeah, I think the prevalent go-to-market strategy that I heard, from the U.S. companies, perfect your business in the U.S. and then, replicate it across the world. And it definitely worked, in a few instances. But I believe now in this much more global world where communications are much better, you can change the playbook and go across the world simultaneously. And that only will accelerate your growth rate. And what you can do in 10 years being a US company, you can probably build in 4 years from a go-to-market perspective if you go globally. Just you need to have a higher tolerance to failure, to experimentation, to just admit there are different cultures. You have to admit it's not so easy to find good leaders, and you will change generations of people. It's a traveling toll that a CEO should be able to take, because you cannot build a global company sitting in your comfort in Bay Area. You have to move your ass around the world. And it's tough. It's not easy. I got like 20 pounds in the process. God, you know, good that COVID helped me to get them back. But 4 years into traveling, I never stay more than two weeks in the same place for 4 years. That's tough. But this is I trace back our growth rates, which were insane, to this global go-to-market simultaneously across the three continents, including Japan. And we've built the biggest business. I think it's for sure the biggest business ever in Japan. In like from 17, 18, it was 19. It was amazing.
And clearly has laid the groundwork for the platform of success now. One of the interesting elements, though, as you talk about the lifestyle implications of a CEO, and this job's hard, the travel's hard in normal times, and the Zoom hours are harder perhaps in the hybrid times. But you also do talk about trying to have some balance in things. One of the anecdotes that I loved about you was this idea that, you know, you're constantly reading, and that sometimes you'll actually read when you wake up in the morning and don't come into the office virtually or digitally or physically until 11 a.m. sometimes, those things. Like, what are your outlets? What are the ways you find balance? What for you helps keep your sanity or some notion of balance in this, you know, 24/7 always on world of tech leadership?
I can say that I think I'm a bit of more anxious nature than I think what is average. And being a bit anxious since I was a kid, I train myself to find some inner peace somehow. When I have a bout of anxiety, I built, you know, since I was like 12, this coping mechanism. One thing that works very well to me is to say, and you know, put things in perspective. It doesn't really matter at the cosmic level what you are gonna do right now. Just focus on the moment. Again, it's that outcome doesn't matter so much. This outcome in a few years, it's not gonna be so important. Even if I think, you know, maybe this is something that entrepreneurs don't ever think, but I'm thinking a lot, you know, of life and death. And I believe life and death are really, you know, one thing. It's not, life will not exist without death. To me, it's laughable, the people that want to live, you know, an infinite life, because that's stupid.
So you can get Zen about this, which is probably a good launch point into the first question that we always ask. We do a rapid fire thing. So if you're game, in our last few minutes, I want to ask you some rapid fire questions and just give the first thing that comes in your mind. And the first one may be super easy for you or overwhelming, but given that you're a prolific reader and our audience always likes referrals for good books, many of our listeners have said they literally order every book that our guests have ever suggested. So a lot of burden on you here. But what's the one book or novel you would recommend for a CEO out there today?
The one that was has the most profound implication for me was a book called The Trial of Kafka.
Awesome. What's the one thing that Bucharest does better than San Francisco in tech?
We have a much nicer terrace life where we can talk tech.
Fantastic. What's the weirdest or most niche app on your phone right now?
Well, I have to look. I'm a pretty conservative guy.
And this is a source of frustration for me that we all have these hundreds of consumer apps on our phones and yet very few enterprise apps. But anything new in there you'd reveal for our audience?
No, I don't think. I had Tinder to test it, but I deleted at some point.
Okay, we won't. We'll keep the Tinder comment then. All right, last question. If you could wave the magic wand and change something about the world, Daniel, what would it be?
I would like to make the world appreciate more critical thinking. Really, I don't like the world going into this polarization when both parts don't listen to each other and they are both righteous. I've seen this. I live this in communism, and I really don't want to go back. Critical thinking, meritocracy, I think are essential things in building a society. That's my true and core belief. So I would use the magic wand for this, for sure.
That is a fantastic aspirational comment to leave our audience with. And with that, that is our show. A huge thank you to Daniel Dines for coming on to Cloud Giants and offering his wisdom and fun anecdotes as our co-founder and CEO of UiPath. Thanks for listening. Thank you, Daniel, for your time and insights. And don't forget, if you're listening to this before August 10th, there's still time to RSVP to the Cloud 100 online. Otherwise, if you've missed the live streaming of our Webby-nominated show, you can get all the content on demand at bvp.com/cloud100. And please do me a favor. I'd appreciate if you'd rate and review the podcast on Apple or wherever you're listening, as it really does help others find the show. Or better yet, share the episode on social media or send it to a fellow entrepreneur, as we're living in a cloud-first world, and I want these stories from top CEOs to help tomorrow's leaders. Until the next episode, I'm Byron Dieter, your host of Cloud Giants.